Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Judd Apatow has been responsible for an amazing amount of the comedy of our time. He's not always the one telling the jokes, but as a writer, director, producer, cultivator of talent, he's been behind cult favorites like Freaks and Geeks and some of Hollywood's biggest comedies, including The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Bridesmaids. So maybe it's a good thing that Apatow's early career as a stand-up comedian didn't exactly take off. But now with a lot of success behind him, he's recently been performing on stage again. And The New Yorker Susan Morrison, who is herself a great cultivator of comedic talent for the magazine, met up with him at one of his favorite comedy clubs.
We're downstairs. Yeah. We're in the actual comedy club.
So we're here in the Comedy Cellar on McDougal Street, which is kind of like a time warp. Judd, why did you want to come here?
I just thought maybe we would promote them and then they'd give me better spots. No, the reason why we're here is just I love it here. It's they've been here 30 years. It's a small comedy club, and I found it really fun to do stand-up here again because you come in and then just Chris Rock walks in or Dave Chappelle or Louie, and there are these magical nights. You know, a few months ago, Chris Rock came in and everyone was like, is he going to go on? And he went on stage and just improvised Oscar jokes for half an hour. I was pretty blown away. And as a comedy nerd, I was in heaven. Because I'm really only a comedian to get to watch stuff like that. It's like that's my pass into the kingdom.
So you started out doing stand-up, and then you hadn't done it for 22 years. Why had you stopped initially?
Well, it's hard to know because it's so easy to rewrite history. One reason was because so many of my friends were so good at it, and I really felt like I'm not as good as them, and it bothered me. And I think I was a little bored of myself. I didn't have much to say. I didn't have a strong point of view. I wasn't angry. I wasn't reinventing the form. And then I kept getting jobs as a writer. I was really good at writing in other people's voices. So if Roseanne Barr said, can you write jokes in my voice? I didn't have any problem doing that. It was much harder to do it for myself.
So when you came back to it, do you think that your years of experience being a television writer and a producer and a husband and a father, I mean, that made you better at it? Or do you think, I hope this isn't insulting, or people laughing at you just because now you're a name brand?
Exactly. Well, I think that they laugh for maybe 2 minutes. You know what I mean? Right. If they don't know you, they'll ride it a little bit. But if I'm a disappointment, it's a drag. So they don't give you the courtesy laugh for too long.
I see. Does it give you something that the rest of your career doesn't? I mean, what do you get out of it that you don't get from being a director and a producer and a writer?
Well, there's so much you want to talk about that you can't do in a movie. Movies are painful. I mean, when they go well, I usually just feel like I dodged a bullet.
Right.
But a good comedy show makes you happy, and then a bad one, you're like, well, I'll do it again tomorrow.
And right, it's this combustive thing. It happens.
It happens.
It's over, and then you can start again the next day.
But if a movie bombs, I'm not sleeping for a while.
Right.
I've wasted millions of dollars of other people's money. A giant corporation is suffering.
Now, when you, last year, you did stand-up at Carnegie Hall and at comedy festivals and also on The Tonight Show, where you killed doing a bit about Cosby. It was your imagining of what Cosby's act would be like today.
Isn't that weird? He's, like, doing stand-up. What do you think his act is like? Do you think he's still talking about it? You think he, like, says, like, you ever been in trouble with the wife? Like, get into the doghouse with the wife. You're in the doghouse with the wife because of something that you did. Like, the other day, there was something about me in the paper, and I didn't want my wife to read the paper. So I got up at 5 a.m. and I snuck out to the driveway to get the paper. And I hid the paper, and the next day I got up and I hid the paper.
Now, you were an early and really ardent voice against Cosby and a defender of his accusers. Why were you so vociferous about it? Is it because you have two daughters? Is it because he was your boyhood hero?
All of that. And I know one of the victims, and I've met a bunch of them since.
Wow.
And when you meet them, it just becomes very obvious. You know, it's a lot of people with the exact same story. He had an MO. He had a way he was behaving. I don't think there's any question that it's true.
Right.
I felt that someone had to say, let's just be honest. He did this, and we can't let this disappear again. He should pay for his crimes, or he should do something for these women. He's worth probably almost $1 billion. You'd think he could do something thoughtful for these people before he dies and do something that shows that he understands that he's hurt people.
Right.
That's what his whole life is about. His whole life is about personal responsibility. So it's
exactly.
very weird
right.
for a guy at the end of it to not take any personal right. responsibility. Right.
But I think what you say, there's a case for reparations, which is kind of interesting about these against these women.
Wouldn't it be amazing if out of the blue, Bill Cosby just said, I hurt a lot of people. I'm a very wealthy man. These people's lives were forever affected by this. And I'm going to try to do something for them. Would that be the greatest lesson to the world?
I mean, maybe he'll hear this.
I doubt it. What do you think he's watching on TV right now?
Now, I read that you told an interviewer once, quote, people have been trained to think that being amused is what's most important in our country. I think that you said that in relation to Donald Trump,
mm-hmm.
right? And we're all kind of guilty. You know, at the beginning of the Trump campaign, even we in the media sort of viewed it as this delightful joke, and then it got scary.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a sense that comedians have become our public intellectuals.
Oh, I think comedians have always pointed out BS. And I think young people have learned to look at the world through that lens. They've looked at it through the Daily Show or the Colbert Report. And I've always said, I feel like a lot of comedy has mocked lack of tolerance. So that's why I think gay marriage was accepted much faster, because people like Jon Stewart were just eviscerating anyone that would have an issue with it. And so you have a whole generation of people who are much more rational.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we'll see how that ultimately plays out, if that's correct. But I think a lot of young people are taking a second look in a way that hopefully is healthy. The Trump thing is different. It's tapping into all sorts of rage and frustration.
Right. Right.
And hopefully as people, you know, figure out, this is what he would do, though. Here's what he would do. Do you agree with these steps
right. Right.
that they, you know, will realize there are probably better people than him to make these decisions?
Now, your parents were divorced when you were an adolescent, and your mom worked in a comedy club, right, which allowed you kind of entree to round-the-clock stand-up.
One summer after my parents separated, my mom was a hostess at the East End Comedy Club in Southampton. I got to watch all the comedians and all the shows all summer, and sometimes I think, maybe my mom did that just for me. What could she have gotten paid? $100 or $50?
I think that is such a beautiful story. I'm sure she did it for that reason.
On some level.
I mean, as a kid, you never think your parent is doing something like that with you in mind. But I'm sure she must have been.
But she seemed to enjoy it, but really loved that I enjoyed it. And so I went to every show all summer.
Amazing. I've read that you thought there's a connection between the upheaval of your parents' divorce and you're ultimately becoming a producer and a writer rather than a performer.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I was a middle child and a child of divorce, so you become someone that tries to create safety. And I always found safety in working, because I always feel like if I'm in motion, I'll be okay. And as a producer, you take the most damaged part of your psyche and you use it for good. So if you're a nervous person and if you have catastrophic thinking and you're always going, what could go wrong?
Yeah.
As a producer, that's the best attribute, because you're thinking, how many days do we need to shoot this? What would be the appropriate budget? How do we make sure we do it in the right amount of hours? And you can run these problems and solve them all day long because you're a nervous person.
And feel in control. No, I mean, it's made me think, when I was 13, my father went crazy and my family imploded. And I'd never drawn the connection between, you know, I started out in my career always wanting to be an editor and not a writer.
Yes.
You know, wanting to kind of shape everything. And that's what you're saying about process. And it's only now in my old age that I feel like I've got it together enough to want to be a writer the way.
Sure, and be
interesting,
and also to be supportive of other people. There's something about that too, where you feel like, oh, I can help people, and I can make people's lives less chaotic. So if I'm working with Amy Schumer, I enjoy giving her an experience as a writer and an actor that's pleasant. But on some level, you're doing it for yourself because you feel like I've had hard times and I like helping people not have hard times.
Right. It's a kind of paying it forward. Now let's talk about your new show on Netflix, Love. A lot of your work is about a man-child getting his act together and growing up. It seems to me that in Love, the Netflix show, it's a woman.
So that'll be $235.
Dude, I don't have my wallet. Can I pay you back later?
This isn't a charity.
I'm good for it. I'll come right back.
Hey, you know what? I got this.
Okay.
And a pack of cigarettes?
Tell us about that as a familiar
arc. I think for comedy, people need to be in distress or a mess. You know, people who have their act together are just not that interesting. So every story is about someone who's a mess or someone who's immature. And as I get older, I'm 48. I don't know anybody who's mature, really. When I talk to them about their lives, everyone's in a panic. Everybody's nervous. Everybody's trying to do the right thing. So I feel like that's just being a human being is being immature. Mm-hmm. Unless you're like, I don't know, Bruce Springsteen?
I hope
Bruce,
not.
Bruce Springsteen mature? I don't think he is mature. Those records are about all of the different things that went wrong in his life and adjustments that he's made. Yeah, so everybody is in turmoil, and that's what I find fun. And I think relationships bring out everything you're struggling with, and
right.
And that's what's interesting about the show. It's two people who are basically hiding who they really are because it's the early romance, and slowly their histories are revealed to each other, and they have to deal with it.
And the show seems to take place in real time.
I feel like what's fun about the show is it's 10 episodes. I think it all takes place over 10 days. And so you're seeing the moment they meet, and then the moment when they have to decide, do they want to go out? And then if they go out, do we want to do that again? And you're seeing all those in-between moments.
Before we were talking about stand-up, which I imagine is pretty scripted, or that you write it out, you memorize it, but your movies utilize a lot of improv. Is Love a show that has a lot of improvisation in it, or do you stick to a script?
There is some improvisation in the show. Paul Rust is one of the UCB greats, and Gillian is very good at it, and there's a lot of people from that world on the show. But we probably improvised more in the first bunch of episodes. But I'd like to tell everyone on any set, if you think of something, just say it. If you're acting and in the moment something occurs to you, no one is ever going to be mad if you just go a completely different way. And that changes how people act because they pay more attention to each other because they know, they may not say the line.
So you have to listen.
You really have to listen because people are going to subtly reword everything all the time.
Right. I know that your movies have so many more thousands of feet of film than most people's movies, and I always
digital
think
memory.
About,
you mean?
Oh, I guess so. Dating myself, I always wonder whether in some future age people could put together like six different versions of Knocked Up something with all the leftover footage. I mean, is that something that worries you?
James Franco asked me if I would give him all of the dailies of Freaks and Geeks. He may have asked for Knocked Up also, and he just wanted to
just play with them, right?
Just play with
collage.
Them. Cut something, turn it into something else, which is a really fascinating idea. I mean, that's what should happen at film school. Like, if you were studying to be an editor, someone should give you 2 million feet of film of Knocked Up and say, okay, don't ever look at the movie again. Turn it into a movie. That would be great.
I'm seeing the Judd Apatow chair at USC.
Exactly.
This is going to be a great tax deduction for you, too. You've got to do
Here's all your heavyweights footage. Go for it.
Now, the Times op-ed columnist Ross Douthat wrote kind of a weird editorial in the Times praising your work for what he called its essential conservatism. Now, I guess what he meant is that the movies often end with a wedding, like a Shakespearean comedy. But how do you respond to that comment?
I'm always for people trying to better themselves. And I'm for people trying to find happiness and love and sanity and relationships. I don't think that's a conservative value. I think it's a human value. So, yeah, I think it's nice to not spend your life alone and miserable. And so in a lot of the movies, people are attempting not to do that. And sometimes they succeed, sometimes they don't. I like showing hope. I like showing people struggle to figure out how to make it work. But I certainly don't think that's a conservative idea. In terms of reproductive rights, obviously I'm very pro-choice. But if people, you know, if it goes back to Knocked Up, you know, if she has an abortion, the movie's over 8 minutes in.
Exactly.
And I thought it was interesting to see two people try to get to know each other. You know, this baby's happening,
yes, right,
and we don't really like each other, but maybe we should see if we're wrong about not liking each other.
Right.
I'm on board.
Yay!
I really appreciate you saying that.
No problem, you know, so I'll tell you, you know, maybe if you could help me by telling me, like, one thing that I am supposed to do, that would be good, because I literally have no idea whatsoever.
I have no idea either.
So, do you want to, like, get together and talk about it or something like that?
Yeah, sure.
Like a date? I mean...
Yeah.
That's Judd Apatow talking with Susan Morrison. I'm David Remnick, and you're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.